Live from the heartland and the crossroads of America, it's Tony Katz today.
So this is happening. They're really going to move in the Republican Party to push out Speaker Mike Johnson. This is happening in real time. We are nuts. Now, the argument from Congressman Thomas Massie, I understand. That's right. Thomas Massie is aligning himself with Marjorie Taylor Greene, putting out on X, quote, "I just told Mike Johnson in conference that I'm co-sponsoring the motion to vacate that was introduced by Marjorie Taylor Greene. He should pre-announce his resignation as Boehner did, so we can pick a new speaker without ever being without a GOP speaker." Oh my. The story here is that Mike Johnson wants to govern. Tony Katz, Tony Katz today, 833-468-8669, 833-GOT-TONY. That's the number. That's how you get to be a part of the show. So what he has done is he has started with the general principle of, we are not voting on some massive piece of legislation that the Senate put forward about spending on Ukraine, spending on Israel, and spending on Taiwan until we do spending on the border. This was the correct move. This was the proper move. As I would argue, this was the only move. This, to me, is not an issue. And this isn't the issue that Marjorie Taylor Greene has. Marjorie Taylor Greene's issue came when the $1.2 trillion spending package came and was voted on, got Democratic support to fund the government. She thought that was unacceptable. I did not. Although I can clearly tell you that we would have plenty of places where we agree that some of the nonsense in that bill, holy nonsense. You need a much larger group. You mean a much larger, number of members who are Republicans. You can't have this razor thin stuff. And then you have an easier chance of making larger scale changes, which I agree with. But I deal with my reality right now, and I work incrementalism. And I think that's where some of us may have a difference, right? This is where we see a difference with each other. So that's where she launched her desire to engage a motion to vacate. Well, now there's been so much pressure because of what's happening in Israel vis-a-vis the attack from Hamas on October 7th and now the attack from Iran. What's happening in Ukraine, because Ukraine is going to lose. They don't have the weaponry. They don't have the ammunition. If you have heard anybody talk about this spending bill, well, you know, it's really a jobs program for the U.S. That is a gross way to describe what is happening, and certainly not the way things were sold. It's almost being discussed as an afterthought. But the story does remain that the money that goes to, quote unquote, Ukraine is actually going as ammunition. The ammunition gets made in the United States, which means U.S. manufacturers would benefit. Now, for some people, this is super exciting. For me, are we looking at this as a jobs program? Because that's not my interest. But I am, maybe you and I differ in this, I am interested in sending Ukraine bullets and guns. Let them do the fighting, but if they want to fight, I support their fight. So there's been a lot of pressure about doing this for Ukraine, a lot of pressure about Israel. The conversation about Taiwan is always ever present and is certainly much more of a story now because Joe Biden is so incredibly weak. If you want to debate that, 833-468-8669, 833-GOT-TONY. Biden created a coalition to take on the Iranians. Biden was part of the coalition with Iran to figure out how they could bomb Israel. Fixed it for you, I believe is the expression. That's how it goes. China takes a look at how the U.S. dealt with Iran on Israel, takes a look at how they weren't able to keep Russia out of Ukraine, and then they take a look at Taiwan, and they say, oh, that's ours. Yeah, what, Tuesday? You want to do that Tuesday? And Tuesday, you got a thing? All right. You know what? Check your calendar. Whenever. It doesn't matter when. We could do it whenever. It's, you know, the soonest we want to take it, boom, bop, bip, we're going to take it. Because they don't believe that the U.S. is tough enough. So now there's this real pressure on. Israel is going to need the help because the president of the United States just tried to commit Israel to a policy of only engaging in a defensive battle, and therefore that means Iron Dome for forever. Until, of course, Iron Dome fails and, 100,000 people die. Which, 100,000 people could die. But, you know what? I don't want to get ahead of myself. I'll get back to that. So you've got all these pressures. And so what Speaker Johnson wants to do is say, instead of lumping it all together, here are four separate bills. One for providing aid to Ukraine, one for providing aid to Israel, one for providing aid to Taiwan, and one on the border. Border funding. Send them up. Let's see what the Senate does. As a concept, I agree with this idea. But you should do the border first. I think that all the things I just mentioned, Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, are all serious things. And I think that we should want to have a say in what's going on. I think we should want to be supportive. I think that is a value to American interests. But how can any American interest really be appreciated if we don't show an interest in America? And that involves a strong and secure southern border. We have to have a strong and secure southern border. If we do not do this, we have nothing. As Kerry Pickett writes in the Washington Times, Marjorie Taylor Greene thinks this idea of putting all these separate pieces of legislation out there is a scam. She didn't say whether she was going to file a motion to vacate the chair over this plan. Enter Thomas Massie, who has now stated that he's going to side with Marjorie Taylor Greene and make this move. Now, he's only making the move to side with her, to co-sponsor this. That doesn't mean that they're going to get to a vote. And Speaker Johnson has told Thomas Massie that he's not going to resign. As I have said it and discussed it and broken this down, if you don't want Mike Johnson as the speaker next term, don't elect him a speaker, but win so you can at least decide who the speaker is, because Speaker Akeem Jeffries is going to suck. It's going to be a lot of bad progressive policies. And if we could be even more clear, I hope you like impeachment, because if Trump wins, you're going to get it. Remember, these people think that impeachment shouldn't be used to settle policy differences. It should be used as a political tool. If Trump gets elected and it's Speaker Akeem Jeffries, the impeachment will come on the third day. The third day of Trump's second term, there will be a third impeachment for the 47th president. Are we taking bets? Because I am more than happy to take your money. We should really get, what are those things you can do, the boxes? You do the squares and everyone picks a square. You know, it's a score. We should pick days. Month and day. We should. Everyone can pick their own. Whoo! Somebody's going to win some loot. Some looty loot. You don't remove the speaker. You get through the election. You get victory. You get control. You gain a larger majority. That's the word I was looking for, majority. And then you have the ability to better hold your own feet to the fire. You think I'm opposed to the idea of removing a speaker? I'm not. I'm not opposed to the idea of removing a speaker at all. All of these politicos are nothing more than cogs in the machine, but we're the machine. And when the cog breaks, you replace the damn cog. Stop getting so emotional. You think I need Matt Gaetz? I don't need Matt Gaetz at all. You think I need Marjorie Taylor Greene? Lauren Boebert? Don't need him. You think I need Thomas Massie? Not at all. I may like some of these people someday and not like them the other. And I could say this about many members of Congress. I could say this about Larry Bouchon. You don't even know who Larry Bouchon is. Yeah, not everybody is stealing headlines. He represents the 8th District of Indiana. He's not running for re-election. If he wasn't doing the job, bloop, I'd just replace him. You think I need to, whether I'm in love with him? There's no love. They're just politicos. That's all. Do the job we need done. But one must understand that it's very hard to get your car to go 50 miles when it's on empty. You need a full tank of gas. You want Congress to do this and that and the other. You have to win with large majorities. And I am not interested in pseudo-intellectuals and emotional brats pushing this idea of get rid of this one and get rid of that one and get rid of the other one. And on my feelings, this, and I only support this guy because only Marjorie Taylor Greene matters or Matt Gaetz matters. No, they don't. You matter. We matter. And we have to get to the place. Do we not agree on the place? Well, I think we seem to agree on the idea that you got to take care of the southern border first. I think Mike Johnson, the speaker, agrees with this. But I think what he's looking at is, let's just pass it. Let's send it up. And then you can blame it all on the Senate. You could blame all of it on the Senate. Every last piece. The House says, some of the House says, yeah, but you're giving up the leverage. I don't know why we didn't do this part and parcel thing earlier. And start with, here's the spending on the border. Pass this, we'll get to the rest of it. I can't answer the question as to why. I can only state that if we remove Mike Johnson as speaker before the election, it is as ridiculous an idea as getting rid of Speaker McCarthy. It will be shooting ourselves in the foot. And when we have Speaker Hakeem Jeffries, I'm going to name names. And I'm going to be very nasty about it. Yeah, I know. That doesn't really do anything, does it? Ah, but it'll make for good radio. Oh, the country will be screwed with its pants on. But as long as we've got good radio for a day, I guess that's all that matters. No, wait, that's not all that matters. That's what I thought. Dark Rogue thinks that this is a response to Johnson voting to pass the FISA bill when it was deadlocked. Maybe. I even said of the FISA vote, this could cost him. Because I think the FISA vote was a mistake. Well, I was opposed to FISA, and then they showed me some classified stuff, and now I love FISA. That's a thing. Although sometimes you see something and you learn something, you're like, wait a second, that just changed my point of view. I'm not sure what throws Thomas Massie into this, but my feelings still hold. You don't do it. You don't do it. Do not do it. Oh, they're Republicans. It's the party of stupid. They'll do it. I'm Tony Katz. Speaking of Mellencamp, he's doing a show and I guess he's lecturing to the crowd and the crowd doesn't want to be lectured to. The crowd has no interest in being lectured to. So they're like, why don't you just play music? And then he goes nuts. It's bleeped. there, producer Jason, but, you know, double check.
Yeah, real quiet. Sucker. Now, here's the thing, man. You don't know me. You don't f***ing know me. Hey, Joe, find this guy and let me see him after the show. Guys, I can stop this show right now and just go home. Tell you what I'm going to do. Since you've been so wonderful, I'm going to cut about 10 songs out of the show. Here we go.
Walks off. John Mellencamp, can't say it on radio. I'll move on. Tony Katz today. What's happening, everybody? Antitrust legislation. That is the story here. The Justice Department launching an antitrust lawsuit against Live Nation and Ticketmaster for how they deal with ticket sales. So this, I think, came to a head for how it handled the Taylor Swift tour. They canceled public sales of tickets after the website crashed. They're going to say that Live Nation uses its dominance to undermine competition for ticketing live events. That sounds about right. Now, I don't go to enough concerts to count, so I don't have to deal with this often, but these complaints about Ticketmaster, these complaints about Live Nation, they've been going on for years. Specifically, the idea that somehow I don't own what it is that I purchased. I bought the ticket. I should be able to do with it what I want. Like, for example, sell the ticket. And then there are people who will say, absolutely not. The ticket is a contract to go at a certain set price, and you don't have the right to profit off of that contract. Funny, I can flip a house, but I can't flip a ticket to see Taylor Swift. That doesn't make any sense. Then there's the idea of monopoly. Ticketmaster controls 80% of the market for primary ticket sales in the largest venues. And they have exclusive ticketing contracts with stadiums and arenas where the high-profile artists perform. I guess what I don't understand is, why can't anybody break into that? It would seem to me that if the stadium wants Ticketmaster, they don't care about the experience for the user. But the user goes anyway because, well, it's the show they want to see, and they're not going to deny themselves. I'm fascinated to see how this plays out, because if you want other ticket sales to get into the game, now you need other venues or any venue to say, we'll use this other service. How does the government force other venues to use a different service? I don't have an answer for that. That is a serious, solid question. How in the world does the federal government force, pick a stadium? How do you force them to use ticket group X as opposed to ticket group Y? I don't know how this is done. I cannot fathom how this gets put together. But I'm very curious to see where this goes, because there are a lot of people who are going to be on the side of the Justice Department all of a sudden, because they've hated Ticketmaster and Live Nation for years. Luckily, Ticketmaster is going to be a little easier to use, because the people who are going to go see John Mellencamp in concert have decided, nah. This is Tony Katz today. We'll be right back. Sometimes I read something and I say, I could have written that. I'm not a natural writer. Writing takes work for me and exhaustion for me. I'm a natural talker. That much is true. Tony Katz today. But I read people who I agree with, and I read people who I disagree with. And I read things to give me a different view on the thinking. And it's one of the reasons that I read Noah Rothman. It's one of the reasons I talk to Noah Rothman, is that it's not always about agreement. But I know that there's a level of seriousness. But when I read his latest over at National Review, and I know how some of you feel about National Review, I'm not even saying you're wrong. The only interpretation of Iran's attack that matters is Israel's. That's the headline. The only interpretation of Iran's attack that matters is Israel's. It's the first time I had ever read Noah Rothman where I thought, that guy's angry. Where I thought, I could have written that. And that's a rare find. Noah Rothman joins me right now. You can find his work at nationalreview.com and his latest book, The Rise of the New Puritans, Fighting Back Against Progressives, War on Fun. We have spoken about many of these issues, whether it be regarding Israel or regarding Ukraine, and really about the American policy of deterrence and how, and I took this from your piece, that clearly this is a wholly abandoned art form. So I would love to start with a baseline. What is deterrence, and some examples of it throughout our modern history, let's say post-World War II, and then what is it that the Biden administration seemingly is trying to replace it with?
Well, deterrence can be best understood as a concept, a concept relating to self-defense, particularly in regards to warfare, but it has broader application. It is roughly the credible threat of escalation held in reserve. So the notion that is conveyed to a potential adversary is that at a time and place of your opponent's choosing, it can increase the costs of aggressive action past the point at which they are absorbable or acceptable. And you don't want that. So it's better for you not to escalate in the first place. That's just general deterrence. And when deterrence breaks down, as it has in the Middle East over the weekend, it can only be restored by increasing those costs, the costs of an aggressive action beyond their benefits, perceived, tangible, or otherwise, to an adversary. This is basically the nature of what deterrence is. And when it breaks down, it doesn't reestablish itself, you know, entropically. It needs to be enforced. And that's why I find myself so frustrated with the behavior of Israel's Western partners and even its Middle Eastern partners, all of whom, I should say, at the outset behaved with incredibly admirable lack of restraint in this attack, in intervening and downing the missiles, ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, suicide drones. Actively, the United States, UK, France, even Saudi Arabia and Jordan. That's wondrous. But what happened subsequently was this effort to lobby Israel against responding at all because that action had been so successful, as though that's at all relevant. Not relevant. Iran executed a brazen attack on Israel, designed, according to one U.S. official who spoke to Semaphore, to cause mass casualties and infrastructure damage. By any rational interpretation of the laws of armed conflict, a state of war exists today between the state of Israel and the Islamic Republic of Iran. Israel's obliged, it must respond in order to reestablish deterrence, because the next attack may not be so unsuccessful. It must deter Iran from executing these attacks at all in the future. And there's only one way to do it, and that's to respond kinetically.
Now, I'm going to let producer Jason really quick just check your connection, maybe reconnect with you, just a little bit of drop here and there. The argument that this leads to is that the Biden administration states that, well, you had 350 missiles and drones dropped on you. You were able to down 346 and a half of them, right? They say 99%. Did the math. It's 346 and a half. So 3.5 missiles, call it 4 missiles, got through, or drones. You won. Take the win. This is the argument. But that argument states that the winning is all defense. That to win, all you have to do is parry the thrust against you and never once thrust back. As a matter of just understanding warfare as a novice or as an expert, that is not how wars are won. Even the very expression in football, the best defense is a good offense. One must engage a response, yet the Biden administration is wholly opposed to this concept. They're opposed to what is known to be the basic standard that one cannot just absorb blow after blow after blow and then call themselves victorious in the fight?
No, it's just goofy. I mean, it's the sort of thing that has infected the thinking among national security professionals across the West, which is why we don't fight wars to victory anymore. We're allergic to the concept of victory. Victory requires an adversary acknowledging and admitting defeat. And defeat is a concept that is meted out on the battlefield. One of the things that frustrates Western policymakers with, for example, the Palestinian status quo, the social compact that prevails in these two very distinct non-contiguous territories that constitute the Palestinian territories, is that they have this weird conception of geopolitics in which they believe they can wage war permanently against Israel, and at some point in the distant future, or maybe even near future, erase the Jewish state from existence, just wipe it off the map. And in order, they say out loud, well, we need a whole new social compact to arise and take the place of this really toxic one that prevails today. Well, how do you do that? How do you incept this new social contract into the political status quo on the ground and the hearts and minds of average Palestinians? Well, the first step, prerequisite, step one, is defeat, is acknowledging that the tools that you have sought to achieve your ends don't work, indeed, have backfired on you. There is one way to get there. We don't know any other. And that is for defeat to be meted out on the battlefield in no uncertain terms, universally acknowledged, at which point the embrace of that condition allows for a more healthier conception of a political status quo to emerge. In the absence of defeat, in the absence of victory, there will be no change. You'll have permanent conflict. And that's how we fought our wars for the last half century or longer. We have not fought for victory. We have fought just enough to achieve the battlefield objectives that we want, but not the broader strategic objectives, strategic goals that change the landscape in our favor. We've not done that. We're afraid of doing that. And the result has been rather unsatisfying, if not disastrous.
Talking to Noah Rothman of National Review, nationalreview.com. Fighting to victory means the other side waves the white flag and says, please stop killing us. That's what it means. And yes, it is certainly seen by far too many as something that is unpleasant. Why can't we be kind? I believe that this is exactly the issue with not only pinpoint warfare, but the whole idea of counterinsurgency. This idea of winning hearts and minds does not work if you're not dealing with a Western civilization focused society. We've proven this again and again and again. But with the Biden administration, it is Western civilization. Yet they believe that the answer here is don't do anything, take the hit and move on. This brings us to what we know about this attack, and that the United States was aware that it was coming and tried to limit its scope, not stop its attempt, but limit its scope. This also goes into those people on the political left and the political right who want to make the claim that it was Israel that bombed an Iranian embassy in Syria, and it wasn't an embassy in Syria. It was a targeted strike against Iranian generals and members of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, what's known as the Quds Force, Q-U-D-S. Why, first of all, do I have my data wrong, and I don't think I do, that the United States knew this attack was coming and didn't stop it, but simply tried to limit the scope of it? And how does this now, this new presentation of success that John Kirby is out there trying to sell, a spokesperson, how does this feel? How is this settling amongst those in the military or in the planning apparatus?
Okay, so a lot of questions there. First, I've seen those reports that the Biden administration, along with Turkey, was encountering through intermediaries, telegraphing from Tehran that this was going to happen. And the Biden administration said, you know, just limit the scope of it. Don't do it. I haven't seen a lot of confirmation on that. I'm reluctant to really dive into that one and sink my teeth into it and fully condemn the Biden administration for its behavior. If those reports are true, it's grotesque. But they are limited so far. Nevertheless, I wouldn't be surprised if that was true. Something that you see from Israel's critics in the West, and especially in the Democratic Party, is the regurgitation of this line that's being promulgated by Tehran, which is this strike in, I think it was April 1st, on inside Syria, one of many strikes that the Israeli Air Force has conducted inside Syria against Israeli Iranian counterparts, Iranian terrorist proxies. The IRGC is a terrorist group, even though it's not the Iranian military proper. That this was this consulate, this diplomatic, facility, which is just nonsense. The two Iranian IRGC who were taken out in that strike were directly linked to ongoing attacks on Israel via Hezbollah in the north. That's been ongoing since October 7th. One of them was implicated in the actual execution of the October 7th massacre. If anybody in your audience hasn't heard that, you should ask yourself why. Why haven't you heard that? Since 10/7, Israel and the United States have been under attack by Iranian proxies. Hamas is an Iranian proxy. Hezbollah is an Iranian proxy. The Houthis are Iranian proxies. The Shiite militias in Iraq and Syria, who, by the way, killed 3 American service personnel and wounded scores more in an attack on Jordan, all Iranian proxies. This is one theater and one adversary attacking all these Western powers and Western allies, including Israel. It's all one conflict. And so in order to fight that conflict, to bring it to a satisfying conclusion from our perspective, you can't limit yourself. You can't tie one hand behind your back and say, well, we're only going to attack these proxies. We're only going to attack here. We're going to ignore this theater because it's diplomatically inconvenient. And fortunately, Iran has taken that off the table. This is extremely unprecedented what happened this weekend. It's not an attack on Israel by these proxy terrorist groups. It's not even an IRGC attack. This was an attack by the Iranian military proper, the Iranian army, not the IRGC. It was claimed by the Iranian regime. It was executed from Iranian territory. There's no interpretation of the laws of war that don't lead us to conclude that this was an act of war that needs to be prosecuted to the fullest. No other country on earth would be asked to absorb this blow and simply sit back and say, well, it was a victory because nobody died.
Well, that's exactly what's being said. And we know that that is madness. Now it comes to the grand question, Noah. Israel will respond. That seems pretty obvious. I love that the Wall Street Journal had a headline that, Gallant and Netanyahu and Gantz have an uneasy relationship. It's not well. None of that matters. They are all unified in this idea that Iran is the enemy and this has to be responded to. When they respond, Joe Biden's going to say, how dare you? Joe Biden's going to say, we don't support you. The political left is going to say, you see, they're just warmongers. They will have what Gad Saad refers to as amnesia of causality. They don't remember that October 7th led Israel to go after Hamas. They won't remember that Iran's attack makes Israel respond. Exactly what moment should the Israelis be worried about the U.S. response? And for the record, I believe already. But what about you?
Oh, that's a really good question. I don't know how much it matters from Israel's perspective right now. And it does, obviously. Israel wants to have as many adverse allies as it possibly can, and the United States is its chief ally, a core ally. But the government would cease to exist tomorrow if Bibi said, I'm not going to respond, I can't respond. Or if they execute a response that seems weak-kneed, if they only execute a series of retaliatory strikes in southern Lebanon, for example, I don't see how the government responds. The thing is that politics happens inside Israel too. It's not as though we're alone. In fact, because it's a responsive democracy, we get to actually have a genuine political interplay in this country, which is unlike the many other Middle Eastern countries that we seem to be so concerned about, more so concerned than Israel. And if Israel were to just decide, or if the Bibi government was decided to take this off, you know, take this on the chin, and Bibi is a pretty cautious leader. He doesn't actually like definitive, you know, attacks on Israel's adversaries, or really, you know, very big, robust assaults on Israel's adversaries in response. I don't think he would survive it. The Israeli people will demand it. If Netanyahu doesn't deliver it, Benny Gantz will, or whatever the successive government is. And it has nothing to do with the United States. America is better served by Israel being on the front lines of a conflict that we share. Iran's our enemy, too. Iran chants death to America, too. They're not confused when they say death to Israel, death to America. This is one conflict. It's about time we saw it that way, too.
Noah Rothman, the piece, the only interpretation of Iran's attack that matters is Israel's. Find that at nationalreview.com. And his book, the latest one, The Rise of the New Puritans, Fighting Back Against Progressives' War on Fun, available at Amazon.com, wherever fine books are sold. Noah Rothman, always appreciate it. More is coming up. I'm Tony Katz. The Dow is up 145, the NASDAQ is up 15, and Trump media continues to fall. They announced that they are going to, over there at Truth Social, launch a live TV streaming platform. I can't tell you how the stock is going to do at any one time. I would like for the whole operation to be successful. That's what I'd like to see. I'd like to see it build. I'm not worried about where the stock price is at any one time. I'm worried about whether or not they have a platform by which people can engage and people can profit. And they let people speak freely. That might be the first part. We watch it. This is Tony Katz today.